This is Trump Watch. I'm John Wiener, live in LA on 90.7 KPFK, talking about what Trump is actually doing, not just what he's tweeting. Later in this hour of Trump Watch, two federal courts yesterday blocked Trump's revised Muslim travel ban, and he's been complaining quite a bit about them. Is all that noise an effort to distract us from the growing evidence that Trump Care, I mean Ryan Care, is in deep trouble? Harold Meyerson will comment. But first, homelessness in L.A. County. Every night, more than 80,000 people are homeless in the county where we live. And now voters have resolved to do something about it. A lot, in fact. To explain things, we turn to Sheila Kuehl. She's an L.A. County supervisor. She was elected in November 2014. Her district runs from Hollywood west to the far end of the San Fernando Valley and north up to Sylmar. Previously, Sheila served 8 years in the state Senate and 6 years in the state assembly. She was the first woman in California history to be named Speaker pro tem of the assembly. She was the first openly gay or lesbian person to be elected to the California legislature. She authored 171 bills on all kinds of crucial topics, including paid family leave, nurse-to-patient ratios in hospitals, protecting the Santa Monica Mountains, and she fought to establish true universal health insurance in California. So she's one of our heroes. Sheila Kuehl, welcome to the program.
John, it's always nice to hear my credits. just so the people in Los Feliz and Atwater Village don't feel left out,
okay.
My district goes all the way east to the river, actually, from the ocean to the river. On this side and the whole San Fernando Valley, it's a fabulous district.
Well, first let's talk about L.A. County, what it is. It's 10 million residents. That makes it bigger than 44 states. And what is the budget of L.A. County?
It's about $30 billion, a little over $30 billion. It's kind of like the five of us running the state of Ohio without a legislature. Because we do everything states do, and as you said, we would be the eighth largest state. But probably more interesting, one out of every 35 Americans lives in L.A. County.
Wow. And and right now, the 10 million residents are governed by the board of five people, consists of four women and one African-American man, and one of the women is Latina. I don't think Congress is 80% female. I looked this up and found that both the Senate and the House are 20% female. So 80% female elected leadership in L.A. County. How did this happen?
Well, it happens, and it's ephemeral. Unfortunately, in this case, it was kind of like some aspects coming together where the woman who was running was the, you know, best candidate and most likely to win. That is not always the case in every district. I could be replaced by a guy and probably will be. Usually five or six men will run, one or two women, but still, it's not likely that there will, for a very long time, be four women on the Board of Supervisors. But Hilda and I can serve for 10 more years. And of course, Catherine and Janice can serve for 12 years. So we'll be there for quite a while. Huh. And it's very interesting. We could even have a fifth woman. Who knows?
It's great. Well, what one of the things that's huge about L.A. County is the homeless population. We survey this. We try to count the homeless. And I read that about 250,000 men, women, and children experience homelessness in L.A. County during some part of the year, and that around 82,000 people are homeless on any given night. To make that number meaningful, let's turn to my home state of Minnesota. 82,000 is about the population of Duluth, and 250,000 is a little less than the population of my hometown of St. Paul. Here in L.A. County, we passed Prop H a couple of weeks ago to provide housing and support for homeless people. Am I right that it passed?
Yes, I'm pretty sure. We're still counting the very last ballots, but we asked our registrar recorder to count those areas that looked to be the worst for Prop H, given the votes that had already been counted in that area, so that we could see, because it was after election night, it was holding at about 67.4%. and you need two-thirds for this particular tax. After they counted the districts that looked like they might be the worst for Prop H that had not, where the provisional ballots had not been counted yet, the mail-ins that came in late but had the right, you know, stamp, just the post office was late, it went up, actually, not down. So it went to 67.8. And yesterday, as they announced the next round of counting provisional ballots, it went up to 68.4.
Wow.
So it looks very good because we counted those areas that we thought might bring it down first, and they didn't. So I feel very confident that Prop H has now passed, and we adopted a plan yesterday at the Board of Supervisors for developing all the ways in which we will increase the staffing and support needed to get that money out the door to fund the 47 different strategies that we developed and announced on February 9th last year.
So let me just review that what happened was that more than two-thirds of the voters in L.A. County voted to raise their taxes, a sales tax increase of 0.25%, to provide services and housing to homeless people. And I read this is going to generate $350 million every year for 10 years. And it's going to start this summer. So I don't think we have time to talk about all. How many strategies do we have?
Well, the 47 strategies are subgroupings of six different large areas. For instance, one of the large areas is prevention, which people don't think about very much. How do we keep people from becoming homeless? And that includes strategies that have to do with income building, like when we raise the minimum wage. That's one of the areas in which we're trying to help people afford the almost unaffordable housing market in Los Angeles. Another is a little help when you're being evicted, to try to keep you in the place, maybe eviction defense, maybe a month's rent, subsidy, something to keep you in your place. It will also include identifying where you need some perhaps a little mental health help to stay in your place, perhaps a little more job training, that one strategy of prevention. Of course, another strategy is what we call rapid rehousing, which is for people who have just become homeless, turning around, getting them right back into some kind of housing so that they don't become chronically homeless, because your health really crashes when you're out on the street. There's no question. And we have to provide so many more services. So we're trying to get you right back into housing, especially if you're a veteran, especially if you have families, but not only. This extra money is really going to help us with individuals who are often sort of at the end of the line.
And I want to talk about politics more generally in L.A. County. L.A. County is Democratic. It's getting more Democratic. Hillary Clinton received 72% of the vote in L.A. County. That makes her the first presidential candidate in history to receive more than 70% of the vote in L.A. County. California, and especially L.A. County, are so different from red America, the states that voted for Trump. I'd like to talk about how L.A. County can set an alternative for progressive policy when the Republicans control the national government. Of course, we've been thinking a lot about the cuts in social services that Republicans in Congress and the White House are planning to impose on us. I'm sure this has occurred to you, too. What are you anticipating you will have to deal with? And then let's talk about how L.A. County can provide an alternative model for the nation.
Well, of course, John, the main issue is money. The federal government collects and distributes so much more money. I mean, it's up in the trillions and trillions. Even though it sounds like our budget is very large at 30-umpty, you know, billion dollars, it is nothing compared to the federal budget. So the federal budget has been providing a major underpinning in our provision of health services and our provision of mental health services, a lot of money. if they change the ACA, even if they don't do away with it, which it looks now they're probably not going to be able to do, but even if they change it, it's going to remove subsidies for people who are getting health insurance now. The impact on the county is, if you don't have health insurance, you use our emergency rooms as your health insurance backup. And so the expense to the county is increased, and the contribution from the feds is decreased. So it's excellent for the voters in LA County to say, God bless the child that's got her own, and to say, I will tax myself to provide mental health and physical health services. It's for homeless people, and there are so many of them, that will actually help offset some of the losses that we are going to experience from the federal government, because the mental health money and the physical health money they've been providing, we've been doing hundreds of millions for homeless already. So hopefully we'll be able to do more, and hopefully the feds won't take away that much. But it's going to be difficult for counties. So all we can really do is tax ourselves and devote more money, not only to homeless services, but to all of the aspects of mental health, physical health, and frankly, very important area, public health, where we do addiction services, where we do, you know, other kinds of public health issues, whether it's Zika or other kinds of things spreading through the communities.
If you've just tuned in, we're speaking with Sheila Kuhl, the LA County Supervisor. We're talking about how California can set an alternative for progressive policy in the age of Trump. Moving away from health, of course, we have another worry about Trump, and that is immigration, what ICE, the immigration police, will do to undocumented people. The undocumented population in LA County, I looked it up, I found the number 814,000 in 2013. To make that number meaningful in Minnesota terms, that's more than the combined population of Minneapolis and St. Paul together. I read the LA County Board of Supervisors created something called a Division to Protect Undocumented Residents. What is that?
Well, in our Consumer Protection Department, we've created a subgroup to deal solely with issues that threaten our immigrant populations. For instance, there has been a spate of fraudulent notarios, the people who allegedly will take a couple of thousand dollars from you and then fail to file your papers. So you thought you had a green card. You should have had a green card if they did the work correctly, but you don't. So we're trying to help those who have been defrauded. Secondly, we're trying to help people who can apply for citizenship to do so, if they haven't done it, to make it sort of make it free, make it easy to get at and help people. In terms of those who are not documented and really don't have the ability to be documented because they did come into the country without documents, we are essentially doing what we can to keep the responsibility on the federal government to deal with them. We can't stop ICE from coming into public spaces. They've gone into our court across the Grand Park here, but they can't go into court rooms. They can come into our building, but they can't go into our private office areas. The sheriff has indicated he is not required by the Constitution to enforce federal laws. And so has Police Chief Charlie Beck and several other police chiefs. So we are doing what we can. Also, the County of Santa Clara and the City and County of San Francisco are filing two separate lawsuits against the Trump administration, which is threatening to withhold funds in a way that already the Constitution says they can't. And we will probably join as amici in those two lawsuits. We decided yesterday in closed session, and it was then announced in open session, that we will be on both amicus briefs.
Yeah, my understanding of the lawsuit is Trump has threatened to cut funding for social programs in retaliation for the refusal of police and sheriffs to cooperate with ICE in identifying undocumented people. My understanding is the law on this is that budgets can be cut only in related fields. So they could cut the police budget, but they can't cut Social Security or Medicare or something like that. Is that have I got that right?
Yes, but also a lot of the federal money that comes to our sheriff's department, for instance, they don't want to particularly cut because they need local police to carry out other kinds of federal programs. I'll give you an example. There's something, a federal program called something like Operation Stonewall or something like that. And it's about border security.
Let me just interrupt for a minute. You sure that Operation Stonewall isn't about gay liberation?
Well, it was. I thought it was a very... I could have this wrong. It could be Cornerstone. It's okay. Got the word stone in it somewhere.
Okay.
San Diego County's taking the lead, and they get the grant. They subgrant to our sheriff's department. What do we have to do with border security? We're not on a border. Oh, but we are. I live in Santa Monica, and that is actually a border. So intercepting sexually exploited children that are being brought in on boats, intercepting drug shipment, etc., that is Los Angeles County's share of being a kind of border patrol. I just learned this week. So we're still getting grants, and we are cooperating with the federal government in doing the things that we want to do and should do. I mean, it is a progressive action to stop sexually exploiting children.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's much more confusing than just undocumented people. And of course, the man in the White House doesn't understand anything but very simplistic, kind of bombastic terms. But they will be, not only constitutionally can't they withdraw that money, but it's not really in their best interest, because there's a lot of stuff they want done that wouldn't get done.
Let's talk about the sheriffs a little more. Very, very important, in especially in this area of immigration enforcement. L.A. County Sheriff is Jim McDonnell. As you've said, he has stated, and the county policy is, deputies will not initiate any police activity based solely on the immigration status of people they come in contact with. That's department policy. That's the law. This is huge because the L.A. County Sheriffs are, I think, the second largest police agency in the country. They respond to 1 million calls annually, according to their website. They also run the nation's largest jail system, 17,000 inmates at any time. So what exactly does it mean that the police will not arrest anyone based solely on their immigration status?
Not only will they not arrest them, they will not inquire about it. And
yeah.
I think that's an important part.
Yes.
Because the federal government requires under some programs that you report the immigration status of people, but you can't report it if you don't collect it.
Yeah.
And there is no reason for the sheriff or any of the law enforcement agencies to collect that information. Now, it is more complicated with the jails, because when you're arrested and fingerprinted, your fingerprints are sent to the FBI. That is by law, because they want to see, are there any other charges out against you, outstanding warrants, and they centralize that. The FBI then reports that you've been arrested and fingerprinted, and that goes to federal agencies, including ICE. So ICE now knows that you've been arrested. They check it against their records, and they find that you are an undocumented person. So they let the sheriff know that they are issuing a detainer order against you. The sheriff does not say, okay, come on into the jail and get this guy. No. The sheriff also does not say, we will hold this person for you beyond the time they're supposed to serve. No. However, the sheriff is required to hand off this person when they're being released, because the release dates are public for everybody. You know, I'm getting out of jail tomorrow. You're getting out of jail the next day. That's public information, believe it or not. And so ICE knows when I'm getting out of jail. So it is not cooperating, but it is kind of a connection.
Yeah. So what are your final thoughts here about how L.A. County can set an alternative for progressive policy to what is happening in our national government in Washington?
Well, L.A. County, I think, is a real beacon, along with a number of other local governments across the country, to say this is what we will do to protect our residents. We have 10 million residents, and we will protect them, we will stand up for them, and we will do our best to provide services for them that they need. We do not care what the federal government tells us. They have no right to tell local government how to conduct its business. And if they threaten us, there are even cases that say, you know, coercion is not constitutional against local governments. Because when the Constitution was written, it was written to tell the federal government what it could do. And the 10th Amendment said, and everything else is up to the states. And as a county, we are an arm of the state. So we actually have a lot of power and decision-making that we can do. We need to stand up for health care. We need to stand up not only for immigrants, but all of our minority communities, whether it's, you know, mosques that are being defaced or temples that are being defaced, Jewish gravestones being, you know, toppled over. I mean, we have a lot to do since Washington is making it more popular to be, you know, discriminatory and violent, frankly. So we are trying to set an example for local governments, and we're big. So we have the ability to say, look at us, here's what we're doing, and we have the resources to develop this and share it with you. And that's what we're going to do.
Sheila Kuehl, she's one of five elected L.A. County supervisors. They run a county that has a bigger population than 44 states. Sheila, thanks for your work, and thanks for talking with us today.
John, it's always a pleasure. Thanks so much for doing this.
It's the same old story. This is Trump Watch. I'm John Wiener, live in L.A. on KPFK, streaming at kpfk.org, and online anytime you want it at trumpwatchpodcast.com. Next up, America's longest war, Afghanistan. For that, we turn to Andrew Bacevich. He's a retired professor of history and international relations at Boston University. He's a graduate of the U.S. Military Academy. He served for 23 years as a commissioned officer in the United States Army. He received his PhD in American diplomatic history from Princeton. He's also taught at West Point and Johns Hopkins. His three recent books, Breach of Trust, Washington Rules, and Limits of Power, all hit the New York Times bestseller list. And his most recent book, America's War for the Greater Middle East, has been longlisted for the National Book Award. He publishes often in The Nation, The LA Times, and The New York Times. Andrew Bacevich, welcome back.
Well, thanks very much.
Well, remind us how long we've been fighting a war in Afghanistan.
Well, it began in October of 2001. That was the first military action that George W. Bush initiated after 9/11, and we've been at it ever since.
And how many American casualties have we had, and how much have we spent?
Well, it's substantially more than 2,000 dead, 20,000 wounded, and I think most surprising is that the total cost of the war, even taking into account inflation, I should say the total cost we've invested in rebuilding that country, even taking account into inflation, is greater than we spent on the Marshall Plan to rebuild Europe after World War II. So the sums are staggering, and I think I would argue, and frankly I think most people would acknowledge, that the results are disappointing at best.
I looked up civilian casualties. The figures that I found were 26,000 civilian deaths due to war-related violence and about 30,000 wounded civilians. Does that sound right to you?
It sounds about right. You know, in this recent piece that I published on Afghanistan, I didn't mention Afghan casualties, and quite frankly, I didn't because I don't think very many Americans care about that. I think they're wrong not to care. I think that the numbers you just cited must factor into any moral evaluation of the results of our war there. But in terms of something that's going to influence American opinion, I don't think very many Americans care about how many Afghans get killed. I don't think they care about how many Iraqis have been killed since we invaded that country in 2003.
So this started out as George W. Bush's war, then it became Barack Obama's war, now it's Donald Trump's war. What has President Trump said about the war in Afghanistan?
Nothing, as far as I know. I mean, he certainly didn't mention the war in his inaugural address. He didn't mention the war in his recent appearance before the Congress. His principal subordinates, such as Defense Secretary Mattis, have rarely spoken about the war. The generals parade back from Kabul and places like that from time to time to render a progress report, but the sort of the general public response to that is basically a shrug. Nobody's paying attention to this war. It occurred to me when I published the recent op-ed, I thought to myself, you know, I think this is like the fourth time I've written the same op-ed. I just keep republishing it every 2 years because nothing much changes. The war continues, money gets spent, people get killed, and the prospect of bringing things to some kind of a conclusion, to being able to achieve our stated political purposes, simply is close to non-existent.
You know, Donald Trump has said we have to start winning wars again. Is there any sign that he has intentions of doing something different that would call a strategy of winning in Afghanistan?
Not that I can see, or in Iraq, Syria, for that matter. I mean, the win-win-win rhetoric was, I think, did figure as a major theme of his candidacy prior to the election. In terms of actions taken with regard to our ongoing wars since the inauguration, it's really been more of the same, with a modest ratcheting up of effort. Recent news reports tell us we now have a small number of U.S. troops in Syria. We're deploying an additional small number of troops to Kuwait, perhaps to be positioned to participate in that war, but it's hard to say that those constitute significant changes to the way that President Obama was conducting the war.
So the general who is currently in command of our forces fighting in Afghanistan, I think most people don't know him, General John Nicholson. I understand he did come to Washington recently to report on its progress. You mentioned this very briefly. What did he have to say about how the war is going there?
Yeah, you know, I have to say you just made an important point that hadn't occurred to me, and that is that I think you're right. 99% of our fellow citizens probably don't know the name of the general who is in charge of conducting the longest war in American history. And I think that alone is indicative of the absence of serious attention. So he did appear before the Senate Armed Services Committee roughly a month ago now, I think, and made a pitch for an additional 5,000 or 6,000 troops. Again, not proposing a radical change in course, but arguing that an additional increment of troops would continue the effort. His presentation described the war as stalemated. You know, we're in his, 16th year? He calls it stalemated, although he said, he used a phrase, something to the effect that an equilibrium that favored the government. I have no idea how to translate that. I do know what stalemated means. And frankly, I don't understand how, at this stage of this long war, introducing a few additional thousand U.S. forces would have any significant impact on that stalemate.
The surge, the famous surge of the Obama years, how many extra soldiers did we send to Afghanistan for the famous surge?
30,000, 30.
And remind us how that worked out.
It didn't work out. It's already a forgotten episode, I think. But to remind listeners, when Obama was running for the presidency, he promised to win the Afghanistan war, bring it to a successful conclusion. In his effort to do that, when General Stanley McChrystal had become the commander there, McChrystal came up with a plan, and the plan said, I'm going to apply counterinsurgency doctrine, and given additional resources, I'm going to demonstrate that counterinsurgency doctrine is the way to win. And Obama gave him 30,000 troops, and Obama gave him an 18-month calendar, and it flat out didn't work. McChrystal had selected a place called Marja as the test case, the proof of concept. He was going to kick the Taliban out of Marja, install a government in Marja, and thereby win the hearts and minds of Afghans in that particular part of the country. It just didn't work. And soon thereafter, McChrystal's kind of imploded when he had the scandal related to the notorious article in Rolling Stone magazine. And as far as I can tell, after McChrystal passed from the scene, we haven't had any commanders who claim that the war is winnable. We are managing a stalemate. One has to wonder when the American people or perhaps somebody on Capitol Hill will ask whether a stalemated war after 16 years is really acceptable.
Well, the big question is, why doesn't anyone in Congress seem to care? Why doesn't anyone in Washington seem to care about the failure of the war in Washington? The failure of the war in Afghanistan.
Yeah. Well, right now, casualties, U.S. casualties, American casualties, are low, infrequent. And the one thing that does seem to get Americans, to include members of Congress, to pay attention to the war is when there's lots of Americans who are being killed.
Yeah.
So low U.S. casualties, which really is a result of the shift in the way we wage these wars under Obama. U.S. casualties went way down. That allows the Congress and the American people to sort of tune the war out. And the result, certainly not intended, but I think of significant consequence, is that war becomes normal.
Yeah.
As I said a moment ago, this is a war that is stalemated, and we are managing the stalemate. So it is no longer controversial. It's almost not even noticeable that the United States of America is at war. And, of course, Afghanistan is not the only war. It happens to be the longest one. But Iraq certainly is a long war. And we have these lesser conflicts that were involved in places like Yemen, Somalia, occasionally Libya, occasionally Pakistan. And there's a remarkably little discussion of when these wars will end or how they could be ended or why they must be continued or what they are costing. It's simply taken for granted that this is, you know, this is what happens in the present moment. We're just a country that is at war.
If you've just tuned in, we're speaking with Andrew Bacevich. He had an important op-ed in the New York Times about the endless Afghan war. Let's talk about our commander-in-chief. Donald Trump often criticizes our recent failures in the wars we are fighting. He said we need, you know, billions more in the military budget because we are not winning wars. And he at the end of February, there was this memorable statement he made, quote, I have to say, when I was young, in high school and college, everybody used to say we never lost a war. We never lost a war. Remember, close quote. Now, Donald Trump was born in 1946. That means he was 7 when the Korean War ended in 1953. He was 29 when the Vietnam War ended in 1975. What were the wars that we won when he was young?
I mean, I think we give him a pass on Korea because he was young, but we certainly don't give him a pass on Vietnam because that's the war he could have participated
yes.
in and managed not to. And we sure as heck didn't win it. We didn't come anywhere close to winning it. But I think what, you know, he's referencing a kind of a mythic collective memory that still sees World War II as the defining episode of modern America. That's kind of what made the country, or that's what brought into existence the golden age when America was great. That he now promises to restore, and in order to maintain that the primacy of World War II in that collective memory, it becomes necessary to forget the other times when we went to war and didn't win. I think he does that. And I dare say that there's some considerable number of our fellow citizens who indulge that selective memory because it makes us feel good to remember the days when, yes, we won. And, of course, even that memory sort of forgets some of the complexities of how we won, and specifically, we won against Nazi Germany because we allied ourselves with the brutal totalitarian dictator Joseph Stalin, and that it was the Red Army that did most of the fighting
yes.
and dying and killing against the Germans. Not that the American contribution was trivial; it was important, but it certainly wasn't as great as that of the Soviet Union.
You know, speaking of World War II as the defining episode, Trump himself talked about this a couple of days ago when he visited the newest aircraft carrier, the USS
right.
Gerald R. Ford. We saw that video of him touring with the captain. And in his comments that day, he talked about the role of aircraft carriers in World War II. He talked about the Battle of Midway. Do you think the Battle of Midway and the role of aircraft carriers in World War II is a good model of how we should win our wars today?
Not at all. But I do think that exemplifies that nostalgia. Trump is now wants to have a major increase in the U.S. Defense budget. It's not clear what the strategic rationale is. It's not. We need to spend the additional dollars with respect to addressing a specific threat. It does rather seem to be that we need to build more aircraft carriers, have a bigger Navy, have a new airplanes in our Air Force, somehow or other, because that will be an expression of an America made great again. So yes, then there's this connection between what the Navy of the 21st century ought to do, needs to look like, how it will be challenged, and yet it somehow merges into memories of what the Navy did in the middle part of the 20th century. I do think there may well be a role for an aircraft carrier, but I think it's time for us to be thinking somewhat more creatively about what are the threats to maintaining open sea lanes, to ensuring that those venues are available, not simply available to us, but so that they're available to global commerce. And having aircraft carriers, if I'm not mistaken, the Gerald R. Ford, I can't remember how many billions of dollars it cost, although it's significant.
A couple.
You need to hear a substantive argument about why more of those is an answer to some particular problem.
Yeah, in fact, we already have 11 aircraft carriers, and Trump wants to build a 12th.
Virtually nobody else has any.
Right.
Of the carriers, of the nuclear attack carriers that are the centerpiece of the fleet, and of which the Ford is going to be yet another example.
We've got just 2 or 3 minutes left here. When Trump says we're going to start winning again, he's speaking directly about ISIS. ISIS is what's on his mind here, and what he calls radical Islamic terrorists. Have you seen any evidence that he has a strategy or that his generals have a strategy of how to defeat ISIS?
Well, I think it's the strategy of the Obama administration.
Yeah.
That is to say that the U.S. military is playing an important role, but it's a supporting role, particularly supporting the Iraqi army, supporting the Kurdish Peshmerga, and having other people bear the burden of the fighting. And quite frankly, I think that that approach is working. It's working agonizingly slowly. It's working at great cost to the local populations as we virtually destroy the cities like Mosul that are liberated. And it would appear that the Islamic State as a territorial entity is on its last legs. That said, ISIS is not identical to the Islamic State. ISIS as a radical terrorist organization still demonstrates very considerable viability in conducting attacks. And even beyond ISIS, there is the question of the conditions that give rise to violent Islamic radicals. And a strategy of winning is going to have to be a strategy that addresses those conditions. And on that score, I myself have heard nothing from Trump or from his Defense Department that suggests that any such strategy exists. They use the term strategy. For the most part, what they're really dealing with is operations.
Andrew Bacevich, he wrote about the never-ending war in Afghanistan for the New York Times op-ed page. Mr. Bacevich, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you very much for having me on.
I'm John Wiener, live in L.A. on 90.7 KPFK with Trump Watch and TrumpWatchPodcast.com. Next up, This Week in Washington, Harold Meyerson will comment. That's in a minute on KPFK when Trump Watch continues. It's the same old story. This is Trump Watch. I'm John Wiener, live in L.A. on KPFK, streaming at kpfk.org and online anytime you want it at TrumpWatchPodcast.com. Coming up at 4 tonight on KPFK, This Is Happening, Jerry Quickly. But now it's time to check in with Harold Meyerson. Of course, he's executive editor of The American Prospect, and he writes regularly for the L.A. Times op-ed page and other publications. We reached him today, as usual, in our nation's capital. Harold, welcome back.
Always good to be here, John.
Well, it has not been a very good week for the president. Trump was on the road for the last couple of days. He was supposed to be plugging the repeal of Obamacare, but instead he complained about the courts rejecting the travel ban, the revised Muslim travel ban. Are you feeling a tiny bit of sympathy for poor Paul Ryan?
No, not at all. No, I mean, there's been a sort of a triple whammy on both Trump and the congressional Republicans this week. First, the Congressional Budget Office scoring of Ryan's attempt to dismantle health care and give a huge tax cut to the rich. The CBO, of course, said that it would deprive 24 million Americans of health coverage, and which made what was already a pretty chancy bill as far as prospects for getting it enacted all the more difficult, I think, to enact. It went through the Budget Committee in the House today, and three members of the marvelously misnamed Freedom Caucus on the far right voted no. You know, and there are plenty, I suspect, there are any number of Republicans, particularly in swing districts, particularly in California, who may vote no for other reasons, that they don't relish the prospect of going before the voters, particularly in the seven districts that Republicans represent, but that Hillary Clinton carried in November, after tens of thousands of them have lost their health coverage. So I think that's triple whammy number one. Number two, as you just alluded, is the court decisions striking down Trump, don't let Muslim immigrants in iteration number two. And then today, we see the Republican, the Trump administration budget that has just been released, which already is being met by catcalls, not only by Democrats, of course, but by Republicans on Capitol Hill, who may be all for slashing government, a la Paul Ryan, but really don't want to have, you know, things like the Great Lakes cleanup project suddenly stopped in mid-flow, or whatever we call it. Republican Senator Rob Portman from Ohio has already said no way on that. Who don't want to see Meals on Wheels stop, particularly when you have a lot of senior voters you're counting on in the next election, and so on. I mean, one general comment about the Trump administration budget. You know, Trump's head is sort of in the 1950s, and that's the image of the nation he has. And you know, maybe the 60s and 70s too. And the image is that programs for the poor mainly help minorities, so they can be cut, and if the minorities are screwed, it won't really upset white working class voters. Well, you know, this ignores the major downward mobility of the white working class over the last 30 years. And a lot of what the Trump budget does is decimate projects that essentially benefit poor whites in rural and areas and former industrial areas and so on. So I don't think there's going to be, I mean, there'll be some support and, you know, some version of the Trump budget will surely be enacted. But I think there's a lot of skepticism among Republicans, chiefly, you know, that the combination of the Ryan healthcare bill and the Trump budget really amounts to an assault on a lot of their own voters, and they ain't going to pass them.
I want to go back just for a minute to Trump care. I mean, Ryan care. We got to keep this straight. Trump doesn't want it called Trump care. Isn't that right?
Well, he knows what happened to Obamacare, that once your name is affixed to a particular health care plan, it doesn't follow that good things are going to happen to you. So he's shying away from that.
So the question here is whether, Trump, it is true that this is not Trump's alternative to Obamacare. Trump told us that his alternative to Obamacare would insure everyone, that it would be a terrific plan, and that it would cost less money. So I can see why he's not as enthusiastic about Ryan care as Paul Ryan would like him to be. So the question then is, well, what happens to Ryan care if the president is not really pushing it very hard?
Well, what happens, you know, we began to see today, as I said, when the Budget Committee, Republicans started voting no on the thing, I imagine it will have a lot of trouble passing the House, that it can't really pass the House unless the bill moves to the right and it does things like end the Medicaid payments even sooner. But that would make it even a deader letter in the Senate, and I have trouble seeing it really passed in the Senate in its current form or in more right-wing form. I mean, it's going to be nibbled away. Whether they can pass anything is a real question. You know, I'm reminded when Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton introduced their health care plan in 1993, an aid to an aide to former Vice President Dan Quayle, who had newly become the editor of a new magazine, that being Bill Kristol, wrote that Republicans should oppose it because any time anything like this is enacted, it's almost politically impossible to roll it back because there'll be too many beneficiaries.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I think I think Bill Kristol was right.
Bill Kristol was right. You heard it here on KPFK.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And, you know, I think that's the problem that Republicans are confronting, not simply that there are too many beneficiaries, but a lot of those beneficiaries are in their districts, and they're people on whose votes a number of Republican Congress members are counting. And, you know, so that is the biggest obstacle here. I don't think I wouldn't be surprised if you know, the bill that is ultimately passed actually does very little, because if they does a lot that Republicans want, Republican ideologues want done, a lot of those ideologues ain't going to be returning to Congress after after the 2018 elections.
So let's move on to the Trump budget, which you talked about briefly. He's proposing a $54 billion increase in military spending. He's proposing to keep Medicare and Social Security untouched, which indeed was one of his promises during the campaign. But to pay for the $54 billion increase, he has to have significant cuts in the rest of the federal government, more than 20% cuts at the Department of Labor, the Department of Agriculture, the State Department, more than 30% cut at the Environmental Protection Agency, but a special appropriation of $2.6 billion for the wall. How do you think, let's talk a little bit more about how, what Republicans are going to want to change about all this.
Well, you know, it's well and good to, you know, under the tenets of conservative ideology to oppose environmental regulation, which presumably is something that interferes with the creation of jobs. But when you cut a program that's actually cleaning up a neighborhood where your constituents live, you know, that gives you some pause. And we've seen some of that pause today, as I mentioned earlier, in terms of the Great Lakes cleanup. And, you know, we're going to see pause on a lot of stuff. there are grandparents who get Meals on Wheels, and I think there are some of those grandparents and some of their kids who have historically voted Republican. I'm not at all sure they're going to be too crazy about this. There's a whole raft of programs that Republicans probably don't want to cut. And this was the case under Ronald Reagan, who came in with a somewhat analogous budget in after his first election in 1980. That was a Democratic Congress at the time, but a lot of, at least a Democratic House, not a Democratic Senate. But they, you know, a lot of this stuff didn't fly then, and a lot of Trump stuff, I think, will not fly now, including a lot of the cuts he's proposed, excuse me, to the State Department, which is the, on a percentage level, second only to the EPA. In terms of
the cut that it's going to take,
the cuts,
yeah,
and I mean the Mike Mulvaney, the budget director under Trump, said, you know, we're going for hard power, not soft power. Soft power is diplomacy. Well, you know, there are a lot of Republicans who actually, you know, have a vision of the world that goes a little beyond some of the more bellicose John Wayne movies. And understand that diplomacy is not inherently a bad thing, even under conservative ideology.
Yes.
So there's already been some pushback there as well.
I'm glad you mentioned the proposed Trump cuts in the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, because that takes us to your Minnesota moment. News from my hometown of St. Paul. Minnesota, of course, is a major beneficiary of the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, which spends $300 million annually to help restore fish and wildlife habitat in Lake Superior, which in other Great Lakes. Lake Superior is 10% of the world's surface fresh water. One of the things that Trump wants to cut is end the proposed Asian carp barrier, which would keep the Asian carp out of Lake Superior. I just want to point out, Trump wants to build a wall to keep Mexican people out of the United States. But what about keeping Asian carp out of the Great Lakes?
Well, you're just carping about that. Sorry. Presumably, the barrier is there because Asian carp, what, they eat other fish?
Yes, they're going to eat the lake trout and the whitefish, Lake Superior whitefish. I bet you've heard of them.
I have indeed.
So this is, again, this is something that the fishermen want, and I believe a lot of the fishermen of Minnesota are Republicans.
They probably are. There's no reason you can't be a fisherman and a Republican. Indeed, I think, as you said, lots of fishermen vote Republican and will not like the Asian carp getting to the fish that they are trying to land before they do.
We just have about 2 minutes left here, and we should mention that an LA jury convicted former Sheriff Lee Baca of three felonies: obstruction of justice, conspiracy, and making false statements. My guess is that the sheriff is going to go to jail, the horrible L.A. County jail that led to his conviction in the, 2 minutes we have left here. Tell us just why this is such a big story.
Well, why it's a big story is the FBI was trying to investigate what was going on in L.A. County jails, and county jails are usually nothing to write home about, but, some horrific things go on there. And the sheriff's department decided to deceive and stonewall the FBI and issued false statements to them, which under any definition I know of is a criminal offense, which is why Lee Baca was convicted. And, you know, Lee Baca for years not only was a popular L.A. Elected official, but, you know, had, you know, reasonable levels of support from I think most Angelenos were cognizant of the existence of a county sheriff, including lots of Democrats. He took some decent positions on social policies, and nobody really knew or sufficiently cared about what was going on in the county jail. Now we know, and now we know that Lee Baca was trying to cover that up.
And credit for this goes to the ACLU of Southern California, and especially to ACLU attorney Peter Eliasberg. He headed up the project that documented the horrors of the Men's Central Jail downtown L.A., the brutality of the guards. That led to a citizens commission, that led to a Justice Department investigation, and that led to the obstruction of justice and the federal trial of a man who was not like Sheriff Joe Arpaio. He was considered one of the good guys.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, so in the case of Joe Arpaio, there was a general rejoicing at the guys finally not being sheriff, but in the case of Lee Baca, this is in a broad sense surprising, disappointing, and also showing that but for the occasionally really vigilant attorneys at places like the ACLU, there's a lot of junk going on that we don't know about and that we should be paying attention to.
Harold Meyerson, read him at prospect.org. Harold, it's always great to have you on the show.
And always great to be here, John.
Well, that's it for today's Trump Watch. I want to thank my other guests. Andrew Bacevich talked about the endless war in Afghanistan. Sheila Kuehl talked about L.A. County's progressive alternatives to Trumpism. Thanks to our engineer, Kiana. Thanks to our producer, Renee Reynolds. Our theme music is Ry Cooter's Mambo Sinuendo. Coming up at 4 tonight on KPFK, This Is Happening, Jerry Quickly. Hey, Trump watchers, if you missed part of this show or any of our recent shows, you can listen online anytime you want at the KPFK archives or at TrumpWatchPodcast.com. Trump Watch returns next week at the same time on the same station. I'm John Wiener. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Michael Slate, host of The Michael Slate Show here on KPFK every Friday morning at 10 a.m. If you're like me and think that there must be a better way of life than under this...